admired the elegant lines of Kentucky rifles. But there were two problems. First, Glass noticed, with disappointment, the rifle's small caliber, which he correctly gauged as .32. Second, the gun's great length made it heavy to carry and cumbersome to load. This was an ideal gun for a gentleman farmer, squirrel hunting in Virginia. Glass needed something different. He handed the Kentucky rifle to Kiowa and picked up the Model 1803, the same gun carried by many of the soldiers in Lewis and Clark's Corps of Discovery. Glass first examined the repair work on the broken stock. Wet rawhide had been tightly stitched around the break, then allowed to dry. The rawhide had hardened and shrunk as it dried, creating a rock-sturdy cast. The stock was ugly, but it felt solid. Next, Glass examined the lock and trigger works. There was fresh grease and no sign of rust. He ran his hand slowly down the half-stock, then continued the length of the short barrel. He put his finger into the fat hole of the muzzle, noting approvingly of the heft of its .53 caliber.
"You like a big gun, huh?"
Glass nodded in reply.
"That big gun is good," said Kiowa.
"Give it a try."
Kiowa smiled wryly.
"Gun like that, you could kill a bear."
Kiowa handed Glass a powder horn and a measure. Glass poured a full charge of 200 grains and dumped it into the muzzle. Kiowa handed him a big .53 ball and a greased patch from his vest pocket. Glass wrapped the ball in the patch and tapped it into the muzzle. He pulled out the ramrod and set the ball firmly in the breech. He poured powder in the pan and pulled the hammer to full cock, searching for a target. 50 yards away, a squirrel sat placidly in the crotch of a big cottonwood. Glass sighted on the squirrel and pulled the trigger. The briefest of instants separated the ignition in the pan and the primary explosion deep in the barrel. Smoke filled the air, momentarily obscuring the target from sight. Glass winced at the stiff punch of the recoil against his shoulder. As the smoke cleared, Kiowa ambled slowly to the foot of the cottonwood. He stooped to pick up the tattered remains of the squirrel, which now consisted of very little beyond a bushy tail. He walked back to Glass and tossed the tail at Glass's feet.
"I think that gun is not so good for squirrels."
This time, Glass smiled back.
"I'll take it."
They returned to the cabin, and Glass picked out the rest of his supplies. He chose a .53 pistol to complement the rifle, a ball mold, lead, powder, and flints, a tomahawk, and a large skinning knife, a thick leather belt to hold his weapons, 2 red cotton shirts to wear beneath the doeskin tunic, a large Hudson's Bay capote, a wool cap and mittens, 5 pounds of salt and 3 pigtails of tobacco, needle and thread, cordage. To carry his newfound bounty, he picked a fringed leather possibles bag with intricate quill beading. He noticed that the voyageurs all wore small sacks at the waist for their pipe and tobacco. He took one of those, too, a handy spot for his new flint and steel. When Glass finished, he felt rich as a king. After 6 weeks with nothing but the clothes on his back, Glass felt immensely prepared for whatever battles lay before him. Kiowa calculated the bill, which totaled $125. Glass wrote a note to William Ashley. October 10th, 1823. "Dear Mr. Ashley, my kit was stolen by 2 men of our brigade with whom I will settle my own account. Mr. Brazeau has extended me credit against the name of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. I have taken the liberty of advancing the attached goods against my pay. I intend to recover my property, and I pledge to repay my debt to you. Your most obedient servant, Hugh Glass."
"I'll send you a letter with the invoice," said Kiowa.
Glass ate a hearty dinner that evening with Kiowa and 4 of his 5 new companions. The 5th, Louis Lavierge Catoire, had yet to emerge from the horse tent. His brother Dominique reported that Lavierge had alternated between bouts of inebriation and fornication since the moment of their arrival at Fort Brazeau. Except when it directly involved Glass, the voyageurs did most of their talking in French. Glass recognized scattered words and phrases from his time on Campeche, though not enough to follow the conversation.
Make sure your brother's ready in the morning, said Langevin. I need his paddle.
He'll be ready.
And remember the task at hand, said Kiowa. Don't be laying up with the Mandans all winter.
I need confirmation that the Arikara won't attack traders on the river.
If I haven't heard from you by New Year's, I can't get word to St. Louis in time to effect planning for the spring.
I know my job, said Langevin. I'll get you the information you need.
Speaking of information, Kiowa switched seamlessly from French to English, we'd all like to know exactly what happened to you, Monsieur Glass.
At this, even the dim eye of Professeur flickered with interest. Glass looked around the table.
There's not much to tell.
Kiowa translated as Glass spoke, and the voyageurs laughed when they heard what Glass had said. Kiowa laughed too, then said,
With all due respect, mon ami, your face tells a story by itself. But we'd like to hear the particulars.
Settling in for what they expected to be an entertaining tale, the voyageurs packed fresh tobacco into their long pipes. Kiowa removed an ornate silver snuff box from his vest pocket and put a pinch to his nose. Glass put his hand to his throat, still embarrassed by his whining voice.
Big Grizzly attacked me on the Grand. Captain Henry left John Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger behind to bury me when I died. They robbed me instead. I aim to recover what's mine and see justice done.
Glass finished. Kiowa translated. A long silence followed, pregnant with expectation. Finally, Professor asked, in his thick brogue, Ain't he gonna tell us any more?
No offense, monsieur, said Toussaint Charbonneau, but you're not much of a raconteur.
Glass stared back, but offered no further detail. Kiowa spoke up.
It's your business if you want to keep the details of your fight with the bear, but I won't let you leave without telling me about the Grand.
Kiowa understood, early in his career, that his trade dealt not only in goods, but also in information. People came to his trading post not just for the things they could buy, but also for the things they could learn. Kiowa's fort sat at the confluence of the Missouri and the White River, so the White he knew well. So too the Cheyenne River to his north. He had learned what he could about the Grand from a number of Indians, but details remained sparse. Kiowa said something in Sioux to his wife, who retrieved for him a well-worn book, which they both handled as if it were the family Bible. The book wore a long title on its tattered cover. Kiowa adjusted his spectacles and read the title aloud.
History of the Expedition,
Glass finished it,
under the command of Captains Lewis and Clark.
Kiowa looked up excitedly.
Ah, bon? A wounded traveler is a man of letters.
Glass, too, was excited, forgetting for a while the pain of speaking.
Edited by Paul Allen, published in Philadelphia, 1814.
Then you're also familiar with Captain Clark's map.
Glass nodded. He remembered well the electricity that accompanied the long-awaited publication of the memoirs and map. Like the maps that shaped his boyhood dreams, Glass first saw History of the Expedition in the Philadelphia offices of Rosthorn and Sons. Kiowa set the book on its spine, and it fell open to Clark's map, entitled A Map of Lewis and Clark's Track Across the Western Portion of North America from the Mississippi to the Pacific Ocean. To prepare for their expedition, Clark had trained intensively in cartography and its tools. His map was the marvel of its day, surpassing in detail and accuracy anything produced before it. The map showed clearly the major tributaries feeding the Missouri, from St. Louis to the Three Forks. Though the map portrayed accurately the rivers that flowed into the Missouri, detail usually ended near the point of confluence. Little was known about the course and source of these streams. There were a few exceptions. By 1814, the map could incorporate discoveries in the Yellowstone Basin by Drouillard and Coulter. It showed the trace of the Zebulon Pike through the southern Rockies. Kiowa had sketched in the Platte, including a rough estimate of its north and south forks. And on the Yellowstone, Manuel Lisa's abandoned fort was marked at the mouth of the Bighorn. Glass pored eagerly over the document. What interested him was not Clark's map itself, which he knew well from his long hours at Rawthorne and Sons, and his more recent studies in St. Louis. What interested Glass were the details added by Kiowa, the penciled etchings of a decade's accreted knowledge. The recurrent theme was water, and the names told the stories of the places. Some memorialized fights, War Creek, Lance Creek, Bear in the Lodge Creek. Others described the local flora and fauna, Antelope Creek, Beaver Creek, Pine Creek, the Rosebud. Some detailed the character of water itself, Deep Creek, Rapid Creek, the Platte, Sulphur Creek, Sweetwater. A few hinted at something more mystical. Medicine Lodge Creek, Castle Creek, Keapaha. Kiowa peppered Glass with questions. How many days had they walked up the Grand before striking the upper fork? Where did creeks flow into the river? What landmarks distinguish the path? What signs of beaver and other game? How much wood? How far to the Twin Buttes? What signs of Indians? Which tribes? Kiowa used a sharp pencil to sketch in the new details. Glass took as well as gave. Though the rough map was etched in his memory, the details assumed new urgency as he contemplated traversing the land alone. How many miles from the Mandan villages to Fort Union? What were the principal tributaries above Mandan? And how many miles between them? What was the terrain? When did the Missouri freeze over? Where could he save time by cutting across the bends in the river? Glass copied key portions of Clark's map for his own future reference. He focused on the expanse between the Mandan villages and Fort Union, tracing both the Yellowstone and the Missouri rivers for several hundred miles above Fort Union. The others drifted away from the table as Kiowa and Glass continued into the night, the dim oil lamp casting wild shadows on the log walls. Hungry at the rare opportunity for intelligent conversation, Kiowa would not release Glass from his grasp. Kiowa marveled at Glass's tale of walking from the Gulf of Mexico to St. Louis. He brought out fresh paper and made Glass draw a crude map of the Texas and Kansas plains.
A man like you could do well at my post. Travelers are hungry for the type of information you possess.
Glass shook his head.
Truly, mon ami. Why don't you lay up for the winter? I'll hire you on.
Kiowa would gladly have paid, just for the company. Glass shook his head again, more firmly this time.
I have my own affairs to attend. Bit of a silly venture, isn't it? For a man of your skills? Traipsing across Louisiana in the dead of winter. Chase down your betrayers in the spring, if you're still inclined.
The warmth of the earlier conversation seemed to drain from the room, as if a door had been opened on a frigid winter day. Glass's eyes flashed, and Kiowa regretted immediately his comment.
It's not an issue on which I asked your counsel. No, monsieur. No, it was not.
There remained barely 2 hours before sunlight when Glass, exhausted, finally climbed up the ladder to the loft. Still, the anticipation of debarkation allowed him little sleep. Glass awoke to a potpourri of shouted obscenities. One of the speakers was a man, screaming in French. Glass did not understand the individual words, but context made their general meaning clear. The speaker was La Vierge Catoire, having just been rudely roused from the depths of a drunken slumber by his brother Dominique. Weary of his sibling's antics and unable to awaken him with the standard kick in the ribs, Dominique tried another tactic. He made water on his brother's face. It was this act of considerable disrespect that triggered the rantings from La Vierge. Dominique's actions also angered the squaw with whom La Vierge had spent the night. She tolerated many forms of indecency in her teepee, some she even encouraged. But Dominique's indiscriminate pissing had soiled her best blanket, and that made her mad. She yelled with the piercing screech of an offended magpie. By the time Glass emerged from the cabin, the yelling match had degenerated into a fistfight. Like an ancient Greek wrestler, Lavierge stood facing his brother without a stitch of clothing. Lavierge had the advantage of size over his elder brother, but he bore the disadvantage of 3 consecutive days of heavy drinking, not to mention a rather abrupt and distasteful awakening. His vision had not cleared, and his balance was off, though these handicaps did not temper his willingness to engage. Familiar with Lavierge's fighting style, Dominique stood firm, waiting for the inevitable attack. With a guttural roar, Lavierge lowered his head and barreled forward. Lavierge put the full momentum of his charge behind the looping swing he aimed at his brother's head. Had he connected, he might well have planted Dominique's nose in the back of his brain. As it was, Dominique parried casually to the side. Missing his target completely, Lavierge's swing threw him completely off balance. Dominique kicked him hard across the back of his knees, sweeping his feet from under him. Lavierge landed square on his back, knocking the wind from his lungs. He writhed pathetically for a moment, gasping for air. As soon as he could breathe again, he resumed his swearing and struggled for his feet. Dominique kicked him hard in the solar plexus, returning Lavierge to his quest for air.
"I told you to be ready, you miserable pinhead. We leave in half an hour."
To underscore his point, Dominique kicked Lavierge in the mouth, splitting his upper and lower lips. The fight over, the assembled crowd broke up. Glass walked down to the river. Langevin's Bataille floated at the dock, the swift current of the Missouri tugging against its mooring rope. As its name implied, the Bataille lay between the normal sizes of voyageur cargo canoes. Though smaller than the big Canot de Maître, the Bataille was sizable, almost 30 feet in length. With the downstream current of the Missouri to propel them, Langevin and Professeur had been able to steer the Bataille by themselves, along with a full load of furs obtained in trade with the Mandans. Fully loaded, the Bataille would have required 10 men to paddle upstream. Langevin's cargo would be light.
"A few gifts to bestow upon the Mandan and Arikara."
Still, with only 4 men to paddle, their progress would be arduous. Toussaint Charbonneau sat atop a barrel on the dock, casually eating an apple, while Professeur loaded the canoe under Langevin's supervision. To distribute the weight of their cargo, they laid 2 long poles on the floor of the canoe from bow to stern. On these poles, Professeur placed the cargo, neatly arranged in 4 small bales. Professeur appeared to speak no French. At times, the Scotsman appeared to speak no English. Langevin compensated for Professeur's lack of comprehension by speaking more loudly. The increased volume aided Professeur very little, though Langevin's constant gesticulating provided a wealth of clues. Professor's blind eye contributed to his dim appearance. He lost the eye in a Montreal saloon when a notorious brawler named Oyster Joe nearly shucked it from the Scotsman's skull. Professor had managed to pop the eye back in place, but it no longer functioned. The unblinking orb was fixed permanently at a skewed angle, as if watching for an attack from his flank. Professor had never gotten around to making a patch. There was little fanfare to their departure. Dominique and Lavierge arrived at the dock, each with a rifle and a small bag of possessions. Lavierge squinted at the glare of the morning sun on the river. Mud caked his long hair, and blood from the split lips painted his chin and the front of his blouse. Still, he hopped spryly into bowsman's position at the front of the Bataille, and a glint filled his eyes that had nothing to do with the angle of the sun. Dominique took the position of the steersman in the stern. Lavierge said something, and both brothers laughed. Langevin and Professeur sat next to each other in the wide middle of the canoe, each paddling to one side. 1 cargo bale sat before them, 1 behind. Charbonneau and Glass arranged themselves around the cargo, with Charbonneau toward the bow and Glass toward the stern. The 4 voyageurs picked up their paddles, bringing the bow into the swift current. They dug deep, and the Bataille moved upstream. Lavierge began to sing as he paddled, and the voyageurs joined in.
"Le laboureur aime son charrue, le chasseur son fusil, son chien, le musicien aimait sa musique, moi, mon canon, c'est mon bien."
His cart is beloved of the plowman. The hunter loves his gun, his hound. The musician is a music lover. To my canoe, I'm bound.
Bon voyage, mes amis, yelled Kiowa. Don't lay up with the Mandans.
Glass turned to look behind him. He stared for a moment at Kiowa Brazo, standing and waving from the dock at his little fort. Then Glass turned to look upriver and did not look back. It was October 11th, 1823. For more than a month, he had moved away from his quarry. A strategic retreat, but retreat nonetheless. Beginning today, Glass resolved to retreat no more. Part 2. 16. November 29th, 1823. Four paddles hit the water in perfect unison. The slender blades cut the surface, pushed to a depth of 18 inches, then dug hard. The batard slogged forward with the stroke, bucking against the heavy flow of the current. When the stroke ended, the paddles lifted from the water. For an instant, it appeared that the river would steal back their progress, but before it could rob them completely, the paddles hit the water again. A paper-thin layer of ice had covered the still water when they embarked at dawn. Now, a few hours later, Glass leaned back against a thwart, basking appreciatively in the mid-morning sun and enjoying the nostalgic, buoyant sensation of floating on water. On their first day out of Fort Brazeau, Glass actually tried to handle a paddle. After all, he reasoned, he was a sailor by training. The voyageurs laughed when he picked up the oar, strengthening his determination. His folly became obvious immediately. The voyageurs paddled at the remarkable rate of 60 strokes a minute, regular as a fine Swiss watch. Glass could not have kept pace even if his shoulder had been fully healed. He flailed at the water for several minutes before something soft and wet hit him in the back of the head. He turned to see Dominique, a mocking grin filling his face.
For you, Mr. Pork Eater.
For you, Mr. Pork Eater. For the rest of their voyage, Glass manned not a paddle, but an enormous sponge, constantly bailing water as it pooled on the bottom of the canoe. It was a full-time job, since the batard leaked steadily. The canoe reminded Glass of a floating quilt. Its patchwork skin of birch bark was sewn together with watope, the fine root of a pine tree. The seams were sealed with pine tar, reapplied constantly as leaks appeared. As birch had become more difficult to find, the voyageurs were forced to use other materials in their patching and plugging. Rawhide had been employed in several spots, stitched on and then slathered in gum. Glass was amazed at the fragility of the craft. A stiff kick would easily puncture the skin, and one of Lavierge's main tasks as steersman was the avoidance of lethal floating debris. At least they benefited from the relatively docile flow of the fall season. The spring floods could send entire trees crashing downstream. There was an upside to the batard's shortcomings. If the vessel was frail, it was also light, an important consideration as they labored against the current. Glass came quickly to understand the odd affection of voyageurs for their craft. It was a marriage of sorts, a partnership between the men who propelled the boat and the boat that propelled the men. Each relied upon the other. The voyageurs spent half their time complaining bitterly about the manifold ails of the craft and half their time nursing them tenderly. They took great pride in the appearance of the batard, dressing it in jaunty plumes and bright paint. On the high prow, they had painted a stag's head, its antlers tilted challengingly toward the flowing water. On the stern, Lavierge had painted the animal's ass.
Good landing up ahead,
said Lavierge from his vantage point on the prow. Langevin peered upriver, where a gentle current brushed lightly against a sandy bank. Then he glanced up to judge the position of the sun.
Okay, I'd say that's a pipe. Allume.
So vaunted was the pipe in voyageur culture that they used it to measure distance. A pipe stood for the typical interval between their short breaks for smoking. On a downstream run, a pipe might represent 10 miles. On flat water, 5. but on the tough pull up the Missouri, they felt lucky to make two. Their days fell quickly into a pattern. They ate breakfast in the purple-blue glow before dawn, fueling their bodies with leftover game and fried dough, chasing away the morning chill with 10 cups of scalding hot tea. They were on the water as soon as the light allowed them to see, eager to squeeze motion from every hour of the day. They made 5 or 6 pipes a day. Around noon, they stopped long enough to eat jerky and a handful of dried apples, but they didn't cook again until supper. They put ashore with the setting sun after a dozen hours on the water. Glass usually had an hour or so of dimming light to find game. The men waited with anticipation for the single shot that signaled his success. Rarely did he return to camp without meat.
Lavierge jumped into the knee-deep water near the bank, careful to keep the batard's fragile bottom from scraping against the sand.
He waded ashore, securing the cordel to a large piece of driftwood. Langevin, Professeur, and Dominique jumped out next, rifles in hand, scanning the tree line. Glass and Professeur covered the others from the canoe as they waded ashore, then followed. The day before, Glass found an abandoned campsite, including the stone rings of 10 teepees. They had no way of knowing if it was Elk Tongue's band, but the discovery put them on edge.
The men pulled pipes and tobacco from the sacks of feu at their waists,
passing a flame from a tiny fire set by Dominique. The two brothers sat on their butts in the sand. In their positions, as bowsmen and steersmen, Dominique and Lavierge stood to paddle. As a consequence, they sat to smoke. The others stood, happy for the opportunity to stretch the kinks from their legs. The cold weather settled into Glass's wounds the way a storm creeps its way up a mountain valley. He awoke each morning stiff and sore, his condition made worse by the long hours at his cramped perch in the batard. Glass took full advantage of the break, pacing up and down the sandbar to coax circulation through his aching limbs. He regarded his travel companions as he walked back toward them. The voyageurs were remarkably similar in dress, almost, thought Glass, as if they had all been issued a formal uniform. They wore red woolen caps with sides that could be turned down to cover their ears, and a tassel trailing off the top. Lavierge dressed his cap with a jaunty ostrich feather. For shirts, they wore long cotton blouses in white, red, or navy, tucked in at the waist. Each voyageur tied a particolored sash around his waist, its ends left to dangle down one leg or the other. Over the sash hung the sac au feu, keeping their pipes and a few other essentials close at hand. They wore doeskin breeches, supple enough to allow the comfortable folding of legs in a canoe. Below each knee, they tied a bandana, adding more dandy dash to their attire. On their feet, they wore moccasins with no socks. With the exception of Charbonneau, who was gloomy as January rain, the voyagers approached each waking moment with an infallibly cloudless optimism. They laughed at the slimmest opportunity. They showed little tolerance for silence, filling the day with unceasing and passionate discussion of women, water, and wild Indians. They fired constant insults back and forth. Indeed, to pass up an opportunity for a good joke was viewed as a character flaw, a sign of weakness. Glass wished he understood more French, if only for the entertainment value of following the banter that kept them all so jolly. In the rare moments when conversation lagged, someone would break out in zestful song, an instant cue for the others to join in. What they lacked in musical ability, they compensated in unbridled enthusiasm. All in all, thought Glass, an agreeable way of life. During this break, Langevin interrupted their brief rest with a rare moment of seriousness.
"We need to start a sentry at night," he said. "Two men each night, half shifts."
Charbonneau blew a long stream of smoke from his lungs.
"I told you at Fort Brazeau, I translate. I don't stand watch." "Well, I'm not pulling extra watch so he can sleep," stated Lavierge flatly.
"Neither," said Dominique. Even Professeur looked distressed. They all looked to Langevin expectantly.
but he refused to allow the dispute to intrude on his enjoyment of the pipe. When he finished, he simply stood and said,
"Allons-y. We're wasting daylight."
5 days later, they arrived at the confluence of the river and a small creek. The crystal water of the stream discolored quickly when it mixed with the muddy flow of the Missouri. Langevin stared at the stream, wondering what to do.
"Let's camp, Langevin," said Charbonneau. "I'm sick of drinking mud."
"I hate to agree with him," said Lavierge, "but Charbonneau's right. All this bad water is giving me the shits."
Langevin, too, liked the prospect of clear drinking water. What bothered him was the location of the stream. On the western bank of the Missouri, he assumed that Elk Tongue's band was west of the river. Since Glass found the recent Indian campsite, the deputation had hung scrupulously to the eastern bank, especially when deciding where to stop for the night. Langevin looked west, where the horizon swallowed the last crimson sliver of sun. He looked east, but there were no landings before the next bend in the river.
"Okay, we don't have much choice."
They paddled to the bank. Professeur and Lavierge unloaded the packs, and with the canoe empty, the voyageurs carried it ashore. There they flipped the boat on its side, creating a rough shelter that opened toward the river. Glass waded ashore, nervously scanning the landing. The sandbar ran 100 yards downstream to natural, jetty-mounded boulders overgrown with thick willows and brush. Driftwood and other debris caught behind the jetty, obstructing the river and forcing it away from the gentle bank. Beyond the sandbar, more willows led to a stand of cottonwoods, increasingly rare as they paddled north.
"I'm hungry," said Charbonneau. "Get us some good supper, Mr. Hunter."
"No hunting tonight," said Glass.
Charbonneau started to object, but Glass cut him off.
"We've got plenty of jerky. You can go a night without fresh meat, Charbonneau."
"He's right,"
agreed Langevin. So they ate jerky, along with fried mush, cooked in an iron skillet over a low fire. The fire drew them close. A bitter wind had diminished with the setting sun, but they could see their breath. The clear sky meant a cold night and a hard frost by morning. Langevin, Dominique, and Lavierge lit their clay pipes and sat back to enjoy a smoke. Glass had not smoked since the grizzly attack. The burning sensation hurt his throat. Professeur scraped mush from the skillet. Charbonneau had walked away from the camp a half hour before. Dominique sang quietly to himself, as if daydreaming out loud.
"I have culled that lovely rosebud. I have culled that lovely rosebud. I have culled petal by petal. Fill my apron with its scent."
"It's a good thing you can sing about it, brother," remarked Lavierge. "I bet you haven't culled any rosebuds for a year. They have to call you the virgin."
"Better to go thirsty than to drink out of every mud hole on the Missouri."
"Such a man of standards, so discriminating."
"I don't see a need to apologize for having standards. Unlike you, for example, I am quite fond of women with teeth. I'm not asking them to chew my food. You'd lay down with a pig if it wore a calico skirt."
"Well, I guess that makes you the pride of the Catoir family. I'm sure Mama would be very proud to know that you only sleep with a fancy horse in Saint-Louis."
"Mama? No.
Papa? Maybe."
They both laughed loudly, then solemnly crossed themselves.
"Keep your voices down," hissed Langevin. "You know how sound carries on the water." "Why are you so cross tonight, Langevin?" asked Lavierge. "It's bad enough putting up with Charbonneau. I've had more fun at funerals."
"We'll be having a funeral if you two keep yelling."
Lavierge refused to let Langevin spoil a good conversation.
"Do you know that squaw back at Fort Kiowa? Had 3 nipples.
"What good are 3 nipples? Asked Dominique.
"Your problem
is that you lack imagination.
Imagination, eh? If you had a little bit less imagination, maybe it wouldn't hurt so bad when you piss.
Lavierge pondered a reply, but in truth, he had grown weary of conversation with his brother. Langevin clearly was not in a talking mood. Charbonneau was off in the woods. He looked at Professeur, with whom he'd never known anyone to have a conversation. Finally, Lavierge looked at Glass. It occurred to him suddenly that they had not really spoken with Glass since leaving Fort Kiowa. There had been scattered exchanges, most concerning Glass's success in putting fresh game in their pot, but no real conversation. Certainly none of the ambling forays on which Lavierge liked to embark. Lavierge felt suddenly guilty for his lack of social graces. He knew little about Glass beyond the fact that he had come up short in a scrape with a bear. More importantly, thought Lavierge, Glass knew little about him, and he must certainly want to know more. Besides, it was a good opportunity to practice his English, a language in which Lavierge considered himself an accomplished speaker.
Hey, pork eater.
When Glass looked up, he said,
from where do you come?
The question and the sudden use of English took Glass by surprise. He cleared his throat.
Philadelphia.
Lavierge nodded his head, waiting for a reciprocal inquiry from Glass. None came. Finally, Lavierge said,
my brother and I, we are from Contrecoeur.
Glass nodded his head, but said nothing. Clearly, decided Lavierge, this American would need to be coaxed along.
You know how it is that we all come to be voyageurs?
Glass shook his head, no. Dominique rolled his eyes, recognizing the prelude to his brother's tired stories.
Contrecoeur is on the great Saint Lawrence River. There was a time, 100 years ago, when all the men in our village were poor farmers. All day, they worked in the fields, but the dirt was bad. The weather too cold, they never made a good crop. One day, a beautiful maiden named Isabelle was working in a field by the river. Suddenly, from the water came a stallion, big and strong, black like coal. He stood in the river, staring at the girl, and she was very afraid. The stallion, he sees that she is about to run away, so he kicks at the water, and the trout goes flying to the girl. It lands there in the dirt at her feet.
Lavierge couldn't find the English word he wanted, so he made a flip-flop motion with his hands.
Isabelle, she sees this petit cadeau, and she is very happy. She picks it up, and she takes it to her family for dinner. She tells her papa and her brothers about this horse, but they think she is making a joke. They laugh and tell her to get more fish from her new friend. Isabelle goes back to the field, and each day now she sees the black stallion again. Each day he comes a little closer, and each day he gives her a gift. One day an apple, one day some flowers. Each day she tells her family about this horse who comes from the river, and each day they laugh at her story. Finally, there comes a day when a stallion walks all the way up to Isabelle. She climbs on his back, and the stallion runs to the river. They disappear into the current, and they are never seen again.
The fire cast dancing shadows behind Lavierge as he spoke, and the rush of the river was like a hissing affirmation of his tale.
That night, when Isabelle doesn't come home, her father and her brothers go looking for her in the fields. They find the tracks of Isabelle, and they find the tracks of the stallion. They see that Isabelle has mounted the horse, and they see that the horse has run into the river. They search up and down the river, but they cannot find the girl. The next day, all the men of the village take to their canoes and join the search. And they take a vow. They will abandon their farms and stay on the river until they find a poor Isabelle. But they never find her. And so you see, Mr. Glass, since that day,
We are voyageurs. Still this day, we keep up the search for the poor Isabel.
Where's Charbonneau?
Asked Langevin.
Where's Charbonneau? Retorted Lavierge. I tell you the story of a lost maiden and you're thinking about a lost old man.
Langevin said nothing in reply.
He's malade comme un chien,
said Lavierge with a smile.
I'll call to him. Make sure he's safe.
He cupped his hand to his mouth and yelled into the willows.
Don't worry, Charbonneau. We're sending a professor to help you wipe your ass.
Toussaint Charbonneau sat on his haunches, his naked ass pointing discreetly toward a bush. He had been in that position for some time, long enough, in fact, that he had begun to develop a cramp in his thigh. He hadn't been right since Fort Brazeau. No doubt he'd been poisoned by Kiowa's shitty food. He could hear Lavierge taunting him from the camp. He was starting to hate that bastard. A twig snapped. Charbonneau bolted upright. One hand reached for his pistol, and the other tugged at his deerskin trousers. Neither hand accomplished its task. The pistol slipped to the dark ground. His pants slipped to his ankles. When he lurched again for the pistol, his pants tripped him. He sprawled on the ground, scraping his knee on a large rock. He grunted in pain, while from the corner of his eye he watched a large elk lope through the timber.
Merde.
Charbonneau returned to his business, grimacing at the sharp new pain in his leg. By the time he'd made his way back to camp, Charbonneau's normal peak had been ratcheted up a notch. He stared at Professeur, who sat reclining against a large log. The big Scot wore a beard of mush.
It's disgusting, the way he eats, said Charbonneau.
Lavierge looked up from his pipe.
I don't know, Charbonneau. The way the fire lights up the porridge on his chin. It kind of reminds me of the Northern Lights.
Langevin and Dominique laughed, which further irritated Charbonneau. Professor continued to chew, oblivious to the humor at his expense. Charbonneau spoke again in French.
Hey, you idiot Scot bastard. Do you understand a word of what I'm saying?
Professor continued to work on the mush, placid as a cow with its cud. Charbonneau smiled, thinly. He appreciated the opportunity for such holy naked cattiness.
What happened to his eye, anyway?
No one jumped at the opportunity for conversation with Charbonneau. Finally, Langevin said,
Poked out in a brawl in Montreal.
It looks like all hell. Makes me nervous, having that damn thing staring at me all day.
Blind eye can't stare,
said Lavierge. He had come to like Professor, or at least to appreciate the Scot's ability with a paddle. Whatever he thought of Professor, he was certain that he did not like Charbonneau. The old man's grousing commentary had grown stale by the first bend in the river.
Well, it sure seems to stare,
insisted Charbonneau.
Always looks like he's peeking around the corner. Never blinks, either. I don't see how that damn thing doesn't dry up.
What if it could see? It's not like you're much to look at, Charbonneau, said Lavierge.
He could at least put a patch over it. I'm tempted to tack one on there myself.
Why don't you? Be nice if you had something to do.
I'm not your damned engagé,
hissed Charbonneau.
You'll be glad I'm alone when the Arikara come looking for your flea-bit scalp.
The translator had worked himself into a frothy lather, spittle forming in the corner of his mouth as he talked.
I was blazing trails with Lewis and Clark when you were still messing your pants.
Jesus Christ, old man, if I hear one more of your damned Lewis and Clark stories, I swear I'm going to put a bullet in my brain, or better than your brain. Everyone would appreciate that. Gosh, shit!
Langevin finally interjected.
Enough! I'd put both of you out of my misery if I didn't need you.
Charbonneau gave a triumphant sneer.
But you listen, Charbonneau, said Langevin. There's none of us that wears just one hat. We're too few. You'll take your turn with the dirty work just like everyone else, and you can start with the second watch tonight.
It was Lavierge's turn to sneer. Charbonneau stalked away from the fire, muttering something about the bitter root as he laid out his bedroll under the batard.
"Who says he gets the batard tonight?"
complained Lavierge. Langevin started to say something, but Dominique beat him to the punch.
"Let it go."
17. December 5th, 1823. Professor woke the next morning to two urgent sensations. He was cold, and he needed to piss. His thick wool blanket failed to cover his ankles, not even when he curled his long frame and lay on his side. He lifted his head so that his good eye could see and found that frost had settled on the blanket in the night. The first hint of a new day glowed faintly beneath the eastern horizon, but a bright half-moon still dominated the sky. All the men but Charbonneau lay sleeping, radiating like spokes around the last embers of the fire. Professor stood slowly, his legs stiff from the cold. At least the wind had died down. He threw a log on the fire and walked toward the willows. He had taken a dozen steps when he nearly tripped on a body. It was Charbonneau. Professor's first thought was that Charbonneau was dead, killed on his watch. He started to yell an alarm when Charbonneau bolted upright, fumbling for his rifle, eyes wide as he struggled to orient himself.
"Asleep on the watch," thought Professor. "Langevin won't like that."
Professor's pressing need became more urgent, and he hurried past Charbonneau toward the willows. Like many of the things he encountered each day, Professor was confused by what happened next. He felt an odd sensation and looked down to find the shaft of an arrow protruding from his stomach. For a moment, he wondered if Lavierge had played some kind of joke. Then a second arrow appeared, then a third. Professor stared in horrified fascination at the feathers on the slender shafts. Suddenly, he could not feel his legs, and he realized he was falling backward. He heard his body make heavy contact with the frozen ground. In the brief moments before he died, he wondered,
"Why doesn't it hurt?"
Charbonneau turned at the sound of Professor falling. The big Scot lay flat on his back with three arrows in his chest. Charbonneau heard a hissing sound and felt a burning sensation as an arrow grazed his shoulder.
"Merde!"
He dropped instinctively to the ground and scanned the dark willows for the shooter. The move saved his life. 40 yards away, the flash of guns erupted in the inky pre-dawn light. For an instant, the shots revealed the positions of their attackers. Charbonneau guessed that there were 8 guns at least, plus a number of Indians with bows. He cocked his rifle, drew a bead on the nearest target, and fired. A dark form slumped. More arrows flew out of the willows. He spun around and broke for the camp, 20 yards behind him. Charbonneau's expletive woke the camp. The Arikara volley ignited chaos. Musket balls and arrows rained into the half-sleeping men like iron hailstones. Langevin cried out as a bullet ricocheted off his short rib. Dominique felt a shot rip the muscle off his calf. Glass opened his eyes in time to watch an arrow bury itself in the sand 5 inches in front of his face. The men scrambled for the paltry cover of the beached canoe as 2 Arikara braves broke from the willows. They hurtled toward the camp, their piercing war cries filling the air. Glass and Lavierge paused long enough to aim their rifles. They fired almost in sync at a range of no more than 12 yards. With no time to coordinate or even to think, they had both aimed at the same target, a large Arikara with a buffalo horn helmet. He crashed to the ground as both shots penetrated his chest. The other brave ran full force toward Lavierge, the arc of his battle axe descending toward the voyageur's head. Lavierge brought his rifle up with both hands to block the blow. The Indian's axe locked with the barrel of Lavierge's rifle, the force knocking both of them to the ground.
The Arikara found his feet first.
His back to Glass, he raised the axe to strike at Lavierge again. Glass used both hands to drive his rifle butt into the back of the Indian's head. He felt the sickening sensation of breaking bone as the metal butt plate connected.
Stunned, the Arikara dropped to his knees in front of Lavierge,
who by this time had scrambled to his feet. Lavierge swung his rifle like a club, catching the Indian full force across the side of his skull. The brave toppled sideways, and Glass and Lavierge tumbled behind the canoe. Dominique raised himself long enough to fire toward the willows. Langevin handed Glass his rifle, the other hand pressed against the bullet hole in his side.
You shoot, I load.
Glass raised to fire, finding and hitting his target with cool precision.
How bad are you hit?
He asked Langevin.
Not bad. Who's that le professeur? Dead by the willows,
said Charbonneau matter-of-factly as he rose to fire. Shots continued to pour from the willows as they hunkered behind the canoe. The report of the guns mixed with the sound of the bullets and arrows smashing through the thin skin of the batard.
You son of a bitch, Charbonneau!
Screamed Lavierge.
You fell asleep, didn't you?
Charbonneau ignored him, focused instead on pouring powder into the muzzle of his rifle.
It doesn't matter now, said Dominique. Let's get the damn canoe in the water and get out of here. Listen to me, ordered Langevin. Charbonneau, Lavierge, Dominique. The three of you carry the boat to the water. Take another shot first, then reload your rifle and lay it here.
He pointed to the ground between him and Glass.
Glass and I will cover you with the last round of shots, then join you. Cover us from the boat with your pistols.
Glass understood most of what Langevin had said from context. He looked around the tense faces. No one had a better idea. They had to get off the beach. Lavierge popped above the lip of the canoe to fire his rifle, followed by Dominique and Charbonneau. Glass raised himself to take another shot as the others reloaded. By exposing themselves, they prompted heavier fire from the Aricara. Bullet-sized holes kept punching through the birch bark, but the voyageurs managed, at least for the moment, to deter an all-out rush. Dominique tossed two paddles on the stack with the rifles.
Make sure you bring these.
Lavierge threw his rifle between Glass and Langevin and braced himself against the middle thwart of the batard.
Let's go.
Charbonneau slid to the front of the canoe, Dominique to the rear. Langevin shouted,
On my count, un, deux, trois.
They lifted the batard above their heads in a single motion and made for the water 10 yards away. They heard excited shouts and the firing again intensified. Aricara warriors began emerging from concealed positions. Glass and Langevin aimed their shots. With the canoe gone, the only cover came from pressing flat against the ground. They were only about 50 yards from the willows. Glass could see clearly the boyish face of an Aricara, squinting as he drew a short bow. Glass fired, and the boy pitched backward. He reached for Dominique's rifle. Langevin's gun exploded next to him as Glass pulled the hammer of Dominique's to full cock. Glass found another target and squeezed the trigger. There was a spark in the pan, but the main charge failed to ignite.
Damn it!
Langevin reached for Charbonneau's rifle while Glass refilled the pan on Dominique's. Langevin started to fire, but Glass put his hand on his shoulder.
Hold one shot!
They scooped up the rifles and paddles and broke for the river. Ahead of Glass and Langevin, the three men with the batard covered the short distance to the river. In their haste to escape, they practically threw the canoe into the water. Charbonneau crashed into the river behind it and scrambled to climb in.
You're tipping it,
yelled Lavierge. Charbonneau's weight on the edge of the craft rocked it wildly, but it stayed upright. He flipped his legs over the lip and flattened himself on the floor of the boat, already taking on water from the seeping bullet holes. Charbonneau's momentum pushed the batard away from the shoreline. The current caught the stern and spun the boat around, propelling the craft away from shore. The long cordel trailed behind it like a snake. The brothers saw Charbonneau's eyes peering above the gunwale. Many geysers from bullets erupted in the water around him.
Grab the rope,
shouted Dominique. Both brothers dove for the line, desperate to keep the canoe from floating away. Lavierge caught the cordel in both hands, struggling to gain his feet in the thigh-deep water. He pulled back with all his strength as the slack disappeared from the line. Dominique slogged heavily through the water to come to his aid. His foot crashed hard into a submerged rock. He grunted in pain as the current swept his feet from beneath him. He found himself completely submerged. He recovered and stood up 2 yards from Lavierge.
I can't hold it, yelled Lavierge.
Dominique started to reach for the taut line, when suddenly Lavierge let go. Dominique watched in horror as the cordel skidded across the water, trailing after the drifting batard. He started to swim after it when he noticed the stunned look on Lavierge's face.
Dominique,
stammered Lavierge.
I think I'm shot.
Dominic sloshed to his brother's side. Blood streamed into the river from a gaping hole in his upper back. Glass and Langevin reached the river at the same moment that the bullet crashed into Lavierge. They watched in horror as he recoiled at the impact of the shot, dropping the cordel. For a moment, they thought that Dominique could grab the line, but he ignored it, turning instead to his brother.
Get the boat,
barked Langevin. Dominique paid no attention. In frustration, Langevin screamed,
Charbonneau! I can't stop it,
yelled Charbonneau. In an instant, the boat was 50 feet from shore. With no paddle, it was true that Charbonneau could do nothing to slow the boat. It was certainly true that he had no intention of trying. Glass turned to Langevin. Langevin started to say something when a musket ball buried itself in the back of his head. He was dead before his body hit the water. Glass looked back at the willows.
At least a dozen Arikara poured toward the shoreline.
Gripping a rifle in each hand, Glass dove toward Dominique and Lavierge. They had to swim for it. Dominique supported Lavierge, struggling to keep his brother's head above the water. Looking at Lavierge, Glass could not tell for sure if he was alive or dead. Distraught and nearly hysterical, Dominique yelled something incomprehensible in French.
Swim for it! Yelled Glass.
He grabbed Dominique by the collar and pulled him deeper into the river, losing his grip on one of the rifles in the process. The current caught the three men and dragged them downstream. Bullets continued to rain into the water, and Glass looked back
to see the Arikara lining the shoreline.
Glass struggled to keep one hand gripped on Lavierge and one hand gripped on the remaining rifle, while kicking furiously to stay afloat. Dominique kicked, too, and they managed to clear the jetty. Lavierge's face kept bobbing beneath the water. Both men battled to keep the wounded man afloat. Dominique started to yell something, which was drowned out when a rapid swamped his own face. The same rapid nearly caused Glass to lose his grip on his rifle. Dominique began to kick toward the shoreline.
Not yet,
Glass implored.
Further downstream.
Dominique ignored him. His feet brushed the bottom in chest-deep water, and he flailed toward the shallows. Glass looked behind them. The rocks of the jetty created a significant barrier on land. The shoreline below the jetty consisted of a high cut bank. Still,
it wouldn't take the Arikara more than a few minutes to maneuver their way around it.
We're too close, yelled Glass.
Again, Dominique ignored him. Glass contemplated swimming on alone, but instead he helped Dominique drag Lavierge ashore. They lay him on his back, reclined against the steep curve of the bank. His eyes flickered open, but when he coughed, blood spit forth from his mouth. Glass rolled him to his side to inspect the wound. The bullet had entered Lavierge's back below his left shoulder blade. Glass saw no way that it could have missed his heart. Dominique came silently to the same conclusion. Glass checked the rifle.
For the moment, the wet charge rendered it useless.
He looked at his belt. The hatchet still hung in its place, but his pistol was lost. Glass looked at Dominique.
What do you want to do?
They heard a soft sound and turned to see Lavierge, the faintest smile at the corner of his mouth. His lips began to move, and Dominique took his brother's hand and held his ear close to understand. In a faint whisper, Lavierge was singing.
Tu es mon compagnon de voyage.
Dominique recognized instantly the familiar song, though never before had it seemed so completely despondent. His eyes welled with tears, and he sang along in a gentle voice.
Tu es mon compagnon de voyage. Je me marie dans mon canot, sur le tombeau près du rivage. Vous renverserez mon canot.
You are my voyager companion. I'll gladly die in my canoe. And on the grave beside the canyon, you'll overturn my canoe.
Glass looked toward the jetty, 75 yards upriver.
Two Arikara appeared on the rocks.
They pointed guns and began to yell. Glass put his hand on Dominique's shoulder. He started to say, "They're coming," but the report of two rifles